So, welcome everybody. This is the second lecture in my series on purification, ethics and karma in early Buddhist discourse. Before I start to get into the actual lecture, there was a few minor things I wanted to say on the blogs. One thing is that the way the blogs are being displayed, it kind of, the website only seems to hold 5 blogs. And so when for every new entry we create a separate blog, then those blogs that have been posted earlier, they kind of disappear. Therefore, I would like to suggest that for lecture 2 and future lectures, I open a single blog for the whole lecture. And any comments or ideas or suggestions or questions you make, you all post them under the same blog. Then it's easy for all of us to see if something new has happened, and we don't have to start searching around for the earlier entries. And the second thing, if you are on the website, under Home and Settings, you can upload a picture of yourself. I personally find it very nice if with the blog entries there's also a picture. It kind of makes the thing more personal. Yeah, so now I'm coming to the actual lecture. First, briefly, I want to review what we did last time, and then I get into the next discourses. So last time I gave a short introduction on the Madhyama Agama collection in general, and then we had a look at the first two Madhyama Agama discourses. Regarding my general introduction, on the webpage I have uploaded an article on the Madhyama Agama. In case you would like to get more information on the Madhyama Agama, you could just download that article and read it. Now, in the blog, there have been a number of very useful and interesting comments, and some of them I replied directly, but others I would like to take up now for the benefit of everyone. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to paste this into the chat. See if that works. Yes. So we are first looking again at the Madhyama Agama number 1 discourse, at those 7 qualities. And I have them here on the blackboard. The first quality was good knowledge of the Buddhist teachings. And there was a very beautiful comment made by Linda Galash that I would like to just share with all of you for the benefit of those who only get the audio file. I'm now going to read this. She says, "The suttas are the cornerstone of my practice. Reading and contemplating a sutta is a part of my daily practice, as is meditation and the attempt to put what I read and experience in meditation into the context of daily life. Not reading the suttas is like trying to get through a labyrinth blindfolded. Every step of the way presents an obstacle. The suttas help one overcome the obstacles. With eyes wide open, there are still more than enough difficulties. Relevance, of course, has many facets and various levels. But at the simplest level, it just means reading a sutta and contemplating the message, putting what one has read and things one has understood into the context of the moment. Like every good text, one can read the suttas again and again, and with each reading, one gleans a tiny bit more of the message. This, coupled with experience and meditation, helps open the door of understanding a wee bit further." Yeah, I think that gives us a very good feeling why good knowledge of the Buddhist teaching, knowledge of the suttas and those other types of texts we had there last time, are right at the top of that listing of 7 qualities. Then there was another comment I'd like to share with you. It goes on the whole set of seven qualities. As you can see on the blackboard, and you might remember, there was a listing of seven qualities. The first was to have good knowledge of the teachings. Then the second, to understand the meaning of what others say. Then to know the proper time for or during meditation. You had some slight differences there between the parallel versions. Then to be restrained in behavior, or else to be moderate with requisites. Also there we had some differences. To know one's own strength and weakness. To be able to adapt one's behavior. And to know how to progress to what is superior. Now, Manfred Wiesberger and Andrea Feller, they have been working out a little bit more correlations of these seven qualities. And the original idea was to correlate them with the Eightfold Noble Path and with the Paramis. And I have edited that a little bit, because the Paramitas, the Paramis, are not found in the early discourses. The whole idea that there are certain qualities that we have to develop now, so that in some very distant time in the future we will be able to walk the path to awakening, is not really found in the earliest strata of text. And so to use the Paramis is very meaningful from a practical perspective, but in my personal feeling, to understand the discourse, it is important that we always stay within the same historical level, that we use not the commentaries, later ideas, but we use the ideas from the discourses itself to understand the discourses. This is why I have edited that entry a little bit. So if we look at these seven qualities, what we have, the first one, I think we already said that, is that good knowledge of the teachings is somewhat similar to right view. Then Manfred Wiesberger and Andrea Feller, they suggest that the second quality, to know the meaning, is to be able to see beyond words, seeing the needs and intentions of others, seeing the implications of what is said and done. And they see a relationship between this and the second path factor of right intention. Then the next one, to know oneself, yeah, actually it comes in a slide, I think it's the Pali sequence, doesn't matter. To know oneself, this is number 5 in the Madhyama Agama. Realistic self-evaluation without self-depreciation or hybris. Knowing and minding one's own business. Working from where one is. Right mindfulness and right effort are the two path factors that they see particularly related to this. Then to know restraint and moderation, this is quality number 4 in the Madhyama Agama listing. Understanding that happiness is not to be found in material things, how true. Understanding the limitation of sense experience. And they see this as related to right intention and right mindfulness. To know the time. That is something I should also do. And that is the number 3 in the Madhyama Agama. Time to talk. Time to be silent. Time to look inward. Time to look outward, to act, to observe. And they see this as right mindfulness, right concentration, but also right speech and right action. Now we come to knowing assemblies. I have it here, quality number 6, able to adopt one's behavior. Being able to move freely and comfortably around different strata and subcultures in a society and adapt one's behavior accordingly. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. And to know distinctions, this is in my listing of the Madhyama Agama is number 7, know how to progress to what is superior. The ability to recognize individual strength and weaknesses, knowing that the person has many different aspects, right view and right mindfulness. And then I think a very nice comment from Andrea Falla again. She says, I often find in reflecting on these lists that as one cultivates one factor, all the others are also pulled along for the ride. So I think this very interesting correlation that has been offered to us here, I think we should not take it too literal that it means only this particular path factor and none others is relevant, but just as some way of giving us a practical feeling for these different aspects. Yeah, I'm not sure if I should stop here now and give time for some questions, or if I may go on to one more point that certainly will call up a number of questions. Maybe I just have a short look. If there's anybody who would like to say or write something, then please type in the chat box. And at some point, we might also try this direct speaking with the hand raising, which on an earlier start we tried and it didn't work so well, but I think we should from time to time also try that out. And I also wanted to say for those of you who are not too comfortable with using English that I'm happy if you write in German or. And then, anyway, I have to repeat what you write in the chat box for the oral record, so I could always translate that. But as there seems to be no questions, then I go to the next comment. This is by Chanida Jantra Srisalai. And it's about the two qualities where we have some differences between the Madhyama Agama and the Anguttara Nikaya version. That was about knowing time and knowing restraint. And Chanida points out that the Madhyama Agama Sutra seems to be more focused on meditative practice than the Anguttara Nikaya does. The monks are taught to be mindful at all times and in all activities. And I found this a very pertinent comment, because in my comparative studies, I found a lot of variations between suttas, but very rarely only significant differences in terms of content or way of presentation. But one of the differences, the nuance of difference that I found, and now I'm going to go into this a little more. I hope you can see the PDF that is moving up. If anything doesn't work, then please let me know. One of the relatively few marked differences I found between Pali discourses, in particular the Majjhima Nikaya, which was what I studied, and Chinese and other parallels, is that there seems to be a slightly stronger emphasis on meditation in general, in Chinese agamas compared to Pali discourses. So I am now going to give you a few examples of this. The first example, they all come from the Majjhima Nikaya. The first example is the Chula Gosinga Sutta. This is a discourse which describes the monk Anuruddha and two other monks, how they are living together in harmony. And the description is very beautiful. It shows how they help each other and are very harmonious. There's an image that says that they blend like milk and butter. And each of them is putting his own wishes at the back and is really concerned about doing things in such a way that the others are fine with it. And part of their conduct is that they usually don't really talk to each other. So even if they have to, like they're describing that, for example, the water, the drinking water needs to be filled, they just give signs to each other by hand, without starting to talk because of such a thing. But every 5 days they meet and have a Dharma discussion. The Madhyama Agama parallel, in the description of how they clean up after they have had their meal, also explicitly says that these monks then take their sitting mats and go to a secluded place to meditate. And it says that when they meet every 5 days, they either meditate together in silence or else discuss the Dharma. So we find in the description, I mean, it's very clear that these monks are deeply meditating practitioners, but we find in the Madhyama Agama description this meditative flavor becomes just a little bit more prominent. My next example is the Dhiganaka Sutta. This is a discourse that reports how Sariputta attained full awakening. Sariputta is one of the two chief disciples of the Buddha. There's quite a number of them, but these two, Sariputta and Mahamoggallana, are perhaps the most famous and outstanding ones. And he was listening to a discourse given by the Buddha to a wanderer, a paribhajaka by the name of Dhiganaka. And we have a number of parallels to this discourse in the two Samyukta Agamas. We have two translations of the Samyukta Agama, one complete one and one partial one. And they seem to stem from slightly different but related transmissions. We have Sanskrit fragments of this discourse. And we have a version in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya. This part is preserved in Tibetan. And each of these parallel versions, they do not only describe that Sariputta became an arahant while he was listening to the discourse, but they indicate that after listening to the discourse, he actually meditated. He contemplated on impermanence, and after that, he became an arahant. So here again, we find that there's a slightly stronger meditative flavor. The Dhammacetya Sutta is another discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, and it describes a situation where King Pasenadi is traveling with two of his attendants, two courtiers. And they put up in the same room, so the king can see what these two are doing during the night. And according to the Pali account, the two the whole night are discussing the Dharma. From other discourses we know that these two attained stream entry and they passed away as once returners, so they would have had good reason to discuss the Dharma. Now, the Madhyama Agama parallel, they spent the first part of the night in silent meditation. In this case, however, we find that we also have a version of this discourse in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, and this time preserved in Chinese and in Tibetan. And it agrees with the Pali version, since it reports that the two courtiers were discussing, they were discussing the qualities of the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. The Dhananjani Sutta, it reports that the Brahmin Dhananjani was reborn in the Brahma heaven after getting an instruction by Sariputta on the Brahma Viharas. The Brahma Viharas are the four divine abodes of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. The Madhyama Agama parallel, which otherwise is fairly similar, explicitly says that he actually practiced these. He practiced these Brahma Viharas and he overcame sensuality, and thereon he was reborn in the Brahma world. Again, we find there's just a more meditation flavor to it. It's not just listening to the discourse, also he practices. The Upakilesa Sutta, it describes a visit paid by the Buddha to a monk by the name of Bhagu. And in the Pali version, the Buddha, basically, he comes to the monk and asks him, are you doing fine and do you have no problem to get alms food? And Bhagu says, I'm fine and I have no problems to get alms food. But in the Madhyama Agama parallel, the Buddha asks him, are you living at ease? And Bhagu answers by giving a whole description of his meditation practice, how he is energetically practicing, developing concentration, and practicing the factors leading to awakening. None of these is found in the Pali version. And my last example is from the Nandakovara Sutta. Here, the monk Nandaka, who has just been told by the Buddha that he should be giving a teaching to the nuns, and so he goes the next morning, collects alms in town, eats them, and then he goes to the nuns' quarters to give a teaching. Here we have a parallel in the Samyukta Agama preserved in Chinese, and again in the Mula Savastivada Vinaya, this time Chinese and Tibetan. And these versions say that after he had gotten his alms and taken his meal, before he goes to the nunnery, he sits for some time in meditation. Yeah, that was a rather long comment by me on a short indication given by Chanida Jantra Srisalai, that I think this is a persistent characteristic that in the Pali discourses, these are just nuances, I mean, but still, there is, one gets a stronger meditative flavor, let me say it like that, when one reads the Madhyama Agama discourse compared to when one reads the Pali version. Yeah, I again want to stop for a moment and see if there are any comments or questions. So here's a comment by Linda. There are so many general comments about meditating in the Majjhima Nikaya. One often reads monks meditate, meditate before it is too late, etc. Nothing really specific, but often. Yeah, definitely. I'm certainly not saying that meditation is absent from the Pali discourses or from the Majjhima Nikaya. Meditation is throughout central in all of the early discourses. My point was mainly based on this topic of what differences we get when we compare parallel versions. And there are no major differences we suddenly discover. There was never any Four Noble Truths or the Buddha told us to enjoy sensuality in order to go to awakening, any of this. But there are some slight nuances. And it is difficult for us to know which is the more original one. And I have very few of these real tendencies that I can actually show up after doing 8 years of comparative studies with the whole Majjhima Nikaya, 400 parallels. I mean, I have gone through a lot of material, but one of those few tendencies that I did notice is precisely what has been mentioned and what I myself didn't notice when we were discussing the Majjhima Agama number one last time. But what fortunately Chanida Jantra Srisalai has brought to our notice, that there is just a slight nuance towards making meditation somewhat more explicit. So there's no question that, say, Pali discourses are against meditation and the others are in favor of meditation or something like that. It's just, these are just very slight nuances that I'm just highlighting. Yeah. Yeah, is it possible, Andrew asked the question, is it possible that the school where the Majjhima Agama, Chinese Majjhima Agama is from, was more into meditation? That's a good question. The thing is, And the Sarvasti Vardhan school, which as far as we know is the school that transmitted the Chinese Madhyama Agama, they seem to have a strong trend towards meditation, that is true. And yeah, but still the Madhyama Agama is not really from a school. Yeah, it's not a product of a school or a product of Chinese Buddhism or whatever. It is actually a collection that has been orally transmitted. And so the school affiliation, I mean, it's definitely a good point that somehow those who transmitted the collection had maybe a stronger interest in meditation. And so it was more natural for them to emphasize these things or keep them in mind as they transmit the discourses. Yeah, I think that is the way we can put it. Good point. So there is Anna, and is there a learning or some sort of academic consensus on which of the two is earlier? If I understand you correctly, you mean which of the two collections is earlier? Can you in some way indicate which of the two you mean? Do you mean the Madhyama Agama compared to the Majjhima Nikaya collection? Or the two, you mean the two leanings in the sense of either giving emphasis to meditation or giving less emphasis to meditation? I personally think that at the earliest stage, meditation was very central. This is the flavor that we get from the early discourses. And I would think that in time, this sometimes was lost out of sight, but then in other times, it also emerged again. So we sometimes have a kind of a revival of the meditative tradition. And the meditation in the earlier stages of Buddhism, as far as we can tell from the text, it seems to be closely related to some degree of learning, in the sense that the development of insight and tranquility in the early discourse is not so much a question of practicing a particular technique, but rather of deepening certain key aspects of the Dharma one has learned through meditative practice. But in the Theravada tradition, we know that by the time when the discourses were handed down to Sri Lanka, there was a problem to ensure their transmission, and there was a historical decision taken to give emphasis to learning over practice, with the argument that if we maintain the transmission of the discourses alive, future generations will have access to the Dharma and be able to develop their practice. If we emphasize just on our own practice, we might get somewhere, but the future is lost. But this decision was taken historically at a time too late, according to my understanding, to be still able to influence the discourses. Yeah, so if there's no more questions, we can come to the result of these seven qualities. There's a comment by Andrea Feller that I would like to share with you. So she says, was a slight difference in the presentation of the results of these seven qualities, where we find that the Madhyama Agama version says that somebody who has these seven qualities gains joy and progresses to awakening. But the Anguttara version says someone who has these seven qualities becomes worthy of support and a source of merit. Now, Andrea Feller, she says, Regarding the different perspective of the two versions of the Sutta, with the Madhyama Agama being more focused on qualities that lead towards liberation, and the Anguttara Nikaya being focused on qualities that make one a beneficial field of merit, I am curious if perhaps the collection the suttas appear in might partly account for this difference in focus. The Anguttara Nikaya has quite a number of suttas that seem to be relevant to householders. At the time of the Buddha, was the teaching about practicing for the sake of merit rather than for liberation more directed towards householders than monastics? Yeah, this is a very, very interesting aspect to look at. These are again nuances regarding the four collections and the emphasis given in them respectively. Before I go into that, I think I need to generally state there is no clear-cut distinction. This is only for lay people, this is only for monks. And there has been in the past the idea by some scholars that lay people are only given talks on merits, that's it, and the path to liberation is only for monastics. And this is not correct. There are quite a number of seriously and intensively practicing lay disciples who reach various stages of awakening. And I have recently published a paper on the Anathapindikovada Sutta in Majjhima Nikaya, where I try to show this, that lay people were also given rather deep instructions on insight. Nevertheless, there is a clear difference in their respective interests. That is, when somebody gets really inspired in the discourses by the Buddha's teachings and wants to do all-out practice, then he or she will naturally choose the monastic path, because that was at that time the most suitable and meaningful way of practicing. Therefore, when lay people are the audience, it seems that, with some exceptions, the interest is more towards the more worldly aspects of the Dharma, which are also there and also important, such as the making of merit. So we can expect from a discourse given to an audience of householders that topics such as merits will be more prominent than from a discourse given to monastics. But again, these are just nuances. Now, on the four collections, what I have for you is, one, there is an indication given in a text called the Vinaya Vibhasha. This is from the Sarvastivada tradition and preserved in Chinese. And it makes certain statements on each of the four collections. I have rearranged the sequence so it corresponds to the sequence in which we are familiar with the four collections from the Pali canon. So it tells us that the Dirgha, the collection of long discourses, is mainly to confront outsiders. The middle collection offers profound doctrines for intelligent people and is therefore employed by those under training. The Samyukta, this is a collection that goes according to topics. The Dirgha is just the very long discourses, and the Madhyama or Majjhima, the middle long discourses. The Samyukta collection sets forth various meditations and is therefore made use of by meditators. And the Ekottarikara or Anguttara collection, this is a collection that collects discourses that have a number in common, in discourses that has items number 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 11. This is just another way of organizing a collection of discourses. The Ekottarika collection is for the sake of gods and men, and is therefore used by preachers. If we look at the collections now in the Pali canon, I find this comment is quite meaningful. In the Digha, in the collection of long discourses, we get these very long discourses which are often given to those who are not yet Buddhists. And a scholar by the name of Joy Manet has documented this and says that the long collection is mainly for, I don't know if I can pronounce this properly in English now, proselyting. It means for the conversion purposes, for introducing those who are new to the teaching, to the teaching of the Buddha and to the superiority of the Buddha. Then the middle long discourses, there's another German scholar who has pointed out that words like Vinaya, Vineti, or Sikkhati, to train, are very often found in the middle long discourses. And we have in fact a number of discourses that are entirely on Vinaya matters. And my own personal feeling is also when somebody is interested in intensive study, I recommend the middle long discourses. That really gives a very good grounding in those things that for those who already consider themselves Buddhist or wanting to walk the Buddhist path, gives them an overview of the central aspects. And the Samyutta, I remember when Bhikkhu Bodhi was translating the Samyutta, I once asked him what he felt about it, and he said that after the Majjhima gives a first overview, the Samyutta is like a selection of close-ups. Obviously, because it sets certain themes, like on mindfulness, on the Eightfold Noble Path or whatever, then the discourses they're collected are really condensed on one topic and show it from all different kind of perspectives. But in this way, it is really useful for using the teachings for meditation purposes. And in the Ekottarika or Anguttara collection, I found personally by research, and this is, I have this right at the bottom, that I found three times as many discourses related to Anathapindika, the famous householder who donated Jeta's grove to the Buddha, than in all the other three Nikayas together. So that the Anguttara or Ekottarika is a collection where we get quite a number of different things, but there is a lot for lay people there. And there's another thing from the Pali commentary tradition. This is from the Sumangala Vilasini, the commentary on the Digha Nikaya. It indicates that when the Buddha had passed away, when the Buddha had passed away and the discourses were being distributed, that chief disciples or their followers, some of them had already passed away, were responsible for the transmission of each collection. So it says the Digha, the collection of long discourses, was given to Ananda and his followers. And Ananda is the way he is being described in the discourses. He's a very devotional person. He's very devoted to the Buddha, the greatness of the Buddha. And this is the theme of the Digha, of the long collections, if we want to give it a theme. And then the middle long discourses were given to Sariputta. Sariputta is one of the two chief disciples I mentioned earlier, and he stands specifically for wisdom. He was outstanding in wisdom. And one discourse indicates that he was in particular responsible for leading disciples to stream entry. And yeah, if you ask me which of the four collections you want for that purpose, I would probably point out for the middle long discourses. It really sets you on the path. Then for the Samyutta collection, according to this commentarial explanation, the Mahakasapa and his disciples were responsible. Mahakasapa is a monk in the thought world of early Buddhism who stands for austerity and intensive practice. I think he's really intense, we can say. And the Samyutta is also intense. It really goes for one subject and really goes through with it. The last Anguttara collection is associated with Venerable Anuruddha. There I am not entirely clear on this relationship. Anuruddha was also one of the chief disciples. he was particularly famous for a supernatural ability, which allowed him to see things happening in heaven and in other realms. Perhaps we should understand that this ability gave him the material to preach on these issues, which again might have been of considerable interest for laity, but I think monks were also interested in that. So with the last one, I'm not entirely sure, but anyway, if we look at this, we see there is, from the perspective of the Sarvastivada tradition, from the perspective of the Theravada tradition, there are different flavors to these four collections. And so the reply I would like to give to that comment made by Andrea Feller is that, yes, the thing that we noticed fits those flavors to some extent, the Madhyama Agama compared to the Anguttara. There's one more comment also on these seven, on the results of these seven. This is by Kucharski Piotr. Just go back to the seven so we can see it better. And he says, I'd like to comment on different perspectives in Madhyama Agama and Anguttara Nikaya on the results arising from development of the seven qualities. From my understanding, it's really not all that different, because as I see it, being worthy of offerings and being unsurpassed field of merit for the world is actually being members of the Arya Sangha, the noble community of those who have reached different stages of awakening. That's how Sangha is often described in the suttas. So in my opinion, what the Anguttara Nikaya is saying is that when one develops the seven qualities, one actually works towards liberation. Then, as a noble person, one becomes a field of merit for other people. I think this is very nice because it helps us again to come back to what is essential. There are differences, they are phrased differently, and I hope I have been able to show that there is some slight nuances to the different collections, but in the end, if we really look close at it, they say closely similar things. Yeah, at this point, again, I would like to invite any kind of questions or comments. And I already take up the next discourse in the meantime. Yeah, you have still time to write your comments if you like on what I said so far. I just want to quickly browse through the second discourse which we looked at last time, because there is a curious technical problem that we have, that whereas it seems that to me and to those who were present live at the last lecture, the discourse number 2 was visible. In the video it was not visible. So I'm just briefly displaying it in the hope that this time it can be seen by everybody. Yeah, and you might remember that was this image of the coral tree in one particular heavenly realm, the heaven of the 33, and it had this images for different stages, the withering leaves for leaving the household, and then buds growing in different stages for the levels of absorption attainment, and the flowers in full bloom for awakening. And there was just one comment by Claudine Discala, which I thought was very nice. She says, in the simile of the coral tree, I was most struck by the idea that the average everyday household or untrained mind can grow and blossom into the Arahant. In the simile, it is all coming from the same tree in different stages. I thought that was a very beautiful point to make, and I just wanted to share that with you. If there are any more questions on these various points I made today. I took a little more time to go through the blog comments. I found some of them nice to say something I would anyway would have wanted to say, and also it is nice that all those who are not able to be present live are giving their input. If there's no further comments, I would then go for the next discourse. I'll just clear out the chat. Yeah. Looks like there are no questions. So I'll just continue talking in the hope that I'm not boring you too much. We come to chapter number three, discourse number three, the discourse on the simile of the citadel. We are getting another simile. The parallel is the Nagarupama Sutta among the seventh of the Anguttara. So I read. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. At that time, the Blessed One addressed the monks. If a king's border town is equipped with seven things and obtains easily and without difficulty an abundance of four types of supplies, then this king's border town will not be wiped out by outside enemies, but only by internal self-destruction. Yeah, it's just a simile. There's a few minor differences in this simile in the Anguttara Nikaya. I will not mention all of them, but one is, for example, that in the Anguttara we are only told that these seven things and four supplies will help so that the border town will not be attacked by outsiders, but the Anguttara does not speak of internal self-destruction. So, what are the seven things with which the king's border town is equipped? First of these is a watchtower has been constructed, built firmly in the earth, indestructible. The second, a moat has been excavated, very deep and wide, well designed and reliable. The third, the town is surrounded by a road that is open and clear, level and wide. Number four, the town has raised an army with the four divisions, elephant troops, cavalry, chariot troops and infantry. Five, the town is provided with weapons, bows and arrows, swords and spears. Number six, a general has been appointed as gatekeeper, one who is sharp-witted and wise in making decisions, brave and resolute, of excellent counsel, who allows entry to the good and keeps out the bad. And the seventh quality, a high rampart has been constructed, extremely solid, plastered with mud and painted with whitewash. All of these are to ensure peace within and to control outside enemies. There's a few minor differences in the Anguttara. Then the Pali version does not tell us that the army is fourfold, or the gatekeeper is not explicitly said to be a general, but I think we can... We need not bother about these small differences. The only one that I think is noteworthy is again a difference in sequence. As you see in the file here, qualities 4 and 5 and the corresponding explanations have swapped places. Which is the original sequence? No idea. does it have any effect on the meaning? I don't think so. It's just one of these natural occurrences in oral transmission that things are remembered, and usually the beginning and the end part is remembered better, but somewhere in the middle they just swap places. So besides those seven qualities, we have the four kinds of supplies that the king's border town needs to have in abundance. So the first, or A, is it is provided with there's a question I want to first reply to that. The question is, internal self-destruction reminds on the things that the Buddha said keep the Lichavis from being conquered by Ajatasattu. Yeah, that's quite true. It could be that some political event of this type has led to a commentary on this discourse, and in the course of transmission this has then become part of the discourse itself. So the four kinds of supplies that the king's border town should have in abundance. It should have plenty of water, grass and firewood. It should have harvested plenty of rice and stored up plenty of wheat. It should have plenty of grains and beans of various sorts. And it should store up ghee, honey, sugar cane, sugar, fish, salt, and dried meat. So now we come to the meaning of the simile. In the same way, if a noble disciple gains seven wholesome qualities and attains four higher states of mind easily and without difficulty, then for this reason the noble disciple will be beyond the reach of King Mara, will not be influenced by evil and unwholesome states, will not be defiled by defilements, and will not be born again. How does a noble disciple gain seven wholesome qualities? The first is, he has or she has firm faith that is deeply settled in the Tathagata, faith with firm roots that cannot be influenced by non-Buddhist recluses or Brahmins, or by gods, Maras, Brahmas, or anyone else in the world. The second is that the noble disciple has at all times a sense of shame. What is shameful, he knows is shameful, namely evil and unwholesome states, which pollute and defile, which have various evil consequences and create the root cause of birth and death. And the third quality, the noble disciple continuously fears wrongdoing. What is wrong, he knows is wrong, namely evil and unwholesome states, and we get the same as above, which pollute and defile, which will have various evil consequences and create the root cause of birth and death. The fourth quality, the noble disciple continuously applies effort, cutting off what is evil and unwholesome, and cultivating wholesome states. He constantly arouses his mind, is single-minded and steadfast regarding the roots of wholesomeness, without giving up his task. The fifth quality, he studies wisely and learns much, retaining it and not forgetting it, accumulating wild learning of what is called the Dharma, which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, which has proper meaning and expression, is endowed with purity, and reveals the holy life. In this way, he studies widely and learns much regarding all the teachings, familiarizing himself with them even 1,000 times, considering and contemplating them with knowledge, vision, and profound penetration. The sixth quality, the noble disciple continuously practices mindfulness, achieves right mindfulness, always recalling and not forgetting what was done or heard long ago. And the seventh quality, the noble disciple develops comprehension and wisdom, attains understanding concerning the rise and fall of phenomena, attains noble penetrative knowledge and discriminative understanding concerning the true cessation of suffering. Yeah. It's not any differences with the Pali version that I think we need to discuss. For example, quality number 5, the Pali counterpart is a little bit less detailed, but the main gist is the same. Yeah, and the 4 higher states of mind that the noble disciple attains are the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th absorption. So question, aren't these qualities inherent in being a noble disciple? If so, why point them out? Noble disciple, are they inherent in a noble disciple? Not sure if all of them are inherent. Yeah, he would have or she would have faith. Maybe some of them are present in a budding stage and need to be further encouraged. And quality number 4, it seems that a noble disciple can also be negligent, so for him or her to develop effort is not something I would think is inevitably included in being a noble disciple, which often, but not exclusively in the discourses, refers to those who have attained the stages of awakening, but not always the case. The noble disciple also need not necessarily be one who studies widely. He or she might have just learned very little. He or she should be having some mindfulness, but whether that is continuous or not is a question that we all are facing in our practice, I believe. Yeah, and the wisdom of understanding the rise and fall of phenomena, there must be some initial insight into impermanence, otherwise one would not become a noble disciple in the sense of attaining stream entry. But penetrative full insight into impermanence and its leading on to the true cessation of suffering, one would have to be an arahant, I think. And yeah, regarding the absorptions, this is much discussed practice that your question is leading me to. The relevance of the absorptions for progress through the stages of awakening, and I have discussed that in my Satipatthana book to some extent. As far as I can see, the first 2 stages of awakening do not necessarily require the ability to attain absorption. So our noble disciple would not necessarily have to be one who attains the 1st or even the 2nd, 3rd and 4th absorption. And my personal hold on the situation is that it is for the sake of non-return and full awakening that one needs to have developed the absorptions. But I think I'll stop at this point, otherwise we'll see. If there's interest, we can discuss it in more detail. So in the case of all these 4 absorptions, the noble disciple is abiding in a happiness that lacks nothing. I like that very much. A peaceful happiness that leads naturally to nirvana. This is what the Buddha said. Having heard the Buddha's words, the monks were delighted and remembered them well. And Andrew says, this seems like the 5 faculties of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I assume you're speaking about the 7. So we have the faith here under the 1st quality. We have the energy under the 4th. We have mindfulness under 6. We have wisdom under 7. And where did I lose concentration? Concentration is obviously the other four higher states of mind. Definitely. Yeah, very good point. Yeah. Well done. Yeah. So here we come now to the main points. There's one difference that I just like to mention. Presentation, the way of presenting what otherwise is fairly similar differs between Madhyama Agama and Anguttara, because the Chinese version, it just lists the 7 qualities and these 4 higher states, and then after them correlates them with the simile. The Anguttara gives each quality together with the simile. It says, the firm faith is like the watchtower, and the sense of shame is like this. So they are both saying the same, but the structure of how they say it is different. This is another very, very, very typical thing that we get in oral transmission. But anyway, both discourses agree on the meaning, on the correlation of this simile of the border town with these different qualities. So the firm faith is like this watchtower or pillar at the entrance of the city. The sense of shame is like the moat, and fear of wrongdoing like the road that goes around the town. The effort is like armies, in the Chinese we had the fourfold armies, elephants, horses, infantry, and chariots. Wide learning is like armory, like the spears and bows and whatever. Mindfulness is the gatekeeper, the famous gatekeeper simile. And wisdom is the rampart. And then with the absorptions, we get the correlation with the 4 provisions. Water, grass, and wood is the first. Rice and wheat the second. Grain, beans the third. And ghee, honey the fourth absorption. At this point, I would like to invite your comments or questions on this main points, any of these correlations that you find interesting, anything you might like to add. And the question I always have at the end of a discourse, in some way, can we relate this to our practice, to our everyday life? Can we make sense out of it? Does noble disciples in this sutra refer to those who have achieved the first state of enlightenment, and the noble disciple in the previous sutra refer to general Buddhists who intend to follow the path? Yeah, in its general use in the sutras, the noble disciple often has that nuance of meaning somebody who has at least achieved or is at least on the path to stream entry, but it is not always entirely so. So we cannot fix it down. We should have the idea that the noble disciple is the opposite to the ignoble non-disciple. That is, the noble disciple is somebody who has certain basic ethic qualities and will keep some basic ethic conduct, and often is one who has practiced to such a degree that he or she is on the path to stream entry or has attained stream entry. But this is not invariably so the case. Yeah, so maybe I say a little bit more on this simile. So what strikes me is that the faith is like a pillar which is deeply embedded in the earth, and that gives me this feeling of firm roots. And shame and wrongdoing, they create a protective space around. And effort, the armies, this is what with what we move forwards. And learning is like, I find the image of the armory helpful. It gives me this idea that the more I have real learning, then in any situation I'm able to take hold of what I need. It's like, I mean, in this battle situation, I don't know, but I suppose in one situation one needs a sword, in another one needs maybe a bow to shoot, and the more of armory one has, the better one can react. Yeah, the simile of mindfulness as a gatekeeper occurs also elsewhere, this kind of screening function of mindfulness, and wisdom as the rampart. But here's a comment. Mode is at the very bottom, one's consciousness. For Ottapa, the German has einen hohen, breiten Rundweg zum Beobachten, a high and broad path that leads around for observation, which makes sense because Ottapa looks forward towards the wise, would say. Yeah, that ability to observe, and that feeling of space we get by shame and wrongdoing. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and with the absorptions, I mean, there's not so much to say, but we see that as going through the four absorption is progressively refined, so also the supplies we get, first are this basic water, grass and wood, and for the fourth absorption then we get ghee and honey, which in ancient India were considered a superior foods that one only gets on special occasions. While some people are typing, I just make a small technical announcement. If you are getting thrown out of the session from time to time, then I was told by the technical people that this is maybe because you're using wireless. And if you use a normal LAN connection, that should not happen. So there's a comment by Andrew. In this Chinese sutta, in the fourth jhana, it says, with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure. I don't really understand this sentence. This is a standard description of the fourth jhana. We have the same also in the Pali version. It says, sukhasacca bahana, dukkhasacca bahana. So with the overcoming of happiness and pain, pubeva, sumanasa, dumanasana, atangama, with the coming to an end of earlier joy and displeasure, adukama sukhang chatutang janang upasampaja viharati, with a neutral feeling he or she dwells having attained the fourth jhana. So that is a standard description which shows that with the fourth absorption, all mental or physical pleasure or pain dichotomy is left behind. There is pure neutrality in this experience. We should at some point go more into the jhanas, I think, but maybe when we get a little further and we come across the jhanas, we can take a closer look at what they mean. There is no difference in the description of the four jhanas between the Chinese agamas and the Pali discourses. He says, I'll have to achieve the fourth jhana to know what it means by previous joy and displeasure. If you can, that's the best solution. I think we leave it at that. The previous joy and displeasure just refers to what you experienced previous to entering the fourth jhana. So this can cover pre-jhana stages, but also in the jhanas. So there is some differences in interpretation about at what jhana what factor is left behind. And offhand, what I recall is one explanation, but that might not be the one from the Pali tradition. I'm not sure, but I believe the idea is that the displeasure, there is a slight nuance of displeasure still in the first absorption, because the depth of concentration is maintained by two factors, vitaka and vichara, initial and sustained mental applications. And so because of having to maintain the concentration, there's a slight wobbliness to the experience, and this is just a nuance of displeasure. And the joy would be sumanasa, so I assume that would correspond to piti, and piti as rapture is a experience, a condition of the mind experienced in the first and second absorption, but is left behind with the attainment of the third absorption. But if you can achieve the experience yourself, you will be able to answer the question better than me, I think. There's another comment by Linda. Sense of shame and fear of wrongdoing seem more like something that counterbalance the others by stressing a certain sort of modesty. Yeah, that's actually true. Yeah, I see the point. Very good. Fear and shame, they hold back. The others are moving forward. There's the faith, effort, mindfulness, wisdom. Yeah, very nice. What really strikes me is this wide learning and armory that I found, because in my own experience when I had become a monk, in the beginning I was just meditating and I thought all this theoretical concern with the suttas is for those who don't really want to meditate. And I did not make particularly much progress. And after getting into some study of the suttas, I found that really gives me the armory, the weapons. I mean, I don't like to think of meditation in terms of fighting and weapon, but in this simile, this is what it gives us, that some learning of the discourses and trying to understand them really gives me the tools to deal with difficulties in meditation. There's another comment here by Manfred. The simile shows the amount of work that is needed to fortify oneself against Mara's armies. Yeah. Yeah. Just like the town on the border, the place where most easily the enemies will attack. And so it needs all these protective measures. And in our attempt to progress on the path, we are like in a border town. Yeah. So I think I'll go still for the next sutra. This is a discourse on the water simile. And there's basically almost no differences that I found worthwhile noting between the Chinese and the Pali version. So I read to you. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. At that time, the Blessed One addressed the monks. I shall teach you about seven persons in the water. Listen closely and pay careful attention. The monks listen to receive instruction. This is a standard phrase that we get very often. So the Buddha said, what are the seven? And now I'm abbreviating. One person remains lying in the water. Another person surfaces but then sinks again. Excuse me. Another person surfaces and remains standing in the water. Another person surfaces and, having remained standing, observes. Another person surfaces and, having observed, crosses over towards the farther bank. Another person surfaces and, having crossed over, reaches the farther bank. Another person surfaces and, having reached the farther bank, is called a person dwelling on the farther bank. The Buddha says, I have taught in brief this simile of seven people in the water, as it has been set out and described above. Do you know what its meaning is, how to explain it, and what its moral is? The monks said to the Blessed One, the Blessed One is the source of the Dharma. The Blessed One is the master of the Dharma. The Dharma comes from the Blessed One. May He explain it. Having heard, we will come to know its meaning fully. Yeah, this question and answer exchange is not found in the Pali version, where the Buddha just on his own continues straight away to give an explanation of what this simile is about. So the Buddha says again, listen closely and pay careful attention. I shall explain the meaning to you. And the monks listen. The Buddha said, what is the meaning of the person that remains lying? Here, a person is obstructed by unwholesome states, defiled by defilements, and experiencing the consequences of evil states, which create the root cause for birth and death. What is the person who, having surfaced, sinks again? Here, a person has surfaced by gaining faith in the true Dharma, keeping the precepts, practicing generosity, learning much and developing wisdom, thereby practicing the true Dharma. At a later time, however, he loses faith, which becomes unstable. He gives up keeping the precepts, practicing generosity, learning much, and developing wisdom. These practices thus become unstable. What is the person who, having surfaced, remains standing? Here, a person has surfaced by gaining faith in the true Dharma, keeping the precepts, practicing generosity, learning much, and developing wisdom, thereby practicing the true Dharma. At a later time, his faith remains firm and is not lost, and his keeping of the precepts, practice of generosity, learning much, and developing of wisdom remain stable and firm and are not lost. What is the person who, having surfaced, remains standing, and having remained standing, observes? Here, a person has surfaced by gaining faith in the true Dharma, and we get all the rest of the description, keeps precepts, generosity, learning, wisdom, and they remain stable and are not lost. Now, being established in the true Dharma, he knows dukkha as it really is, knows the arising of dukkha, knows the cessation of dukkha, and knows the path to the cessation of dukkha as it really is. Through such knowing and seeing, three fetters are eliminated, namely personality view, clinging to precepts, and doubt. And through the cessation of these three fetters, he attains stream entry. So this text introduces us to the first of the four stages of awakening recognized in early Buddhism. And what marks this experience of stream entry is that three conditions or states called fetters are gone forever. and these are the belief that there is a permanent self at the essence of existence, of experience. These are clinging to precepts and observances in the sense that one believes that the path to freedom is only possible by this particular way of acting and doing. It doesn't mean that one disregards the precepts, it just means the dogmatic adherence to them as the sole way to liberation. And doubt in the sense of knowing what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. All these three are eradicated, and we usually understand this as an expression of what happens at the time when the stream enterer attains for the first time in his or her life the experience of nirvana. That experience is such that it is incomparable to any other type of experience, and in particular that it is an experience where the I and me that usually is always there in any other type of experience is gone. So having had that experience, the stream enterer knows for himself or herself that this I, that there is no permanent observer inside, let me put it like this. And with that experience also, that deep sense of doubt is gone. There might still be doubt about, like, should I go left or right in order to get to this and that place? I mean, we are not talking about these things. We are just talking about this essential doubt about what is important in life and what is really wholesome and meaningful and what is unwholesome and not meaningful. And the third is the clinging to precepts, this idea that just by following a certain outward form of behavior, everything else will happen by itself. So such a stream enterer is assured of progress towards full awakening within at most 7 existences, without falling into evil states. Having passed through at most 7 existences in heavenly or human realms, he will attain the ending of suffering. So that was what we briefly mentioned before about energy and effort. A stream enterer who makes a lot of effort can still get further and even this life make an end. But he or she, according to early Buddhist doctrine, will at most experience another 7 lives. The experience of stream entry has had such a profound impact on this person that during these 7 lives, sooner or later, he or she will continue to progress and become totally liberated. Come to the next. What is the person who, having surfaced, remains standing? Having remained standing, observes, and having observed, crosses over. Here a person has surfaced by gaining faith in the true Dharma, and again the passage we had above should be understood. And through knowing and seeing dukkha, 3 fetters are eliminated, namely personality view, clinging to precepts and doubt. Having eliminated these 3 fetters, he also reduces sensual desire, anger and ignorance, and attains once returning. Having passed through 1 existence in a heavenly or human realm, he will attain the ending of suffering. This is the second stage of awakening recognized in early Buddhism, where the fetters of sensual desire and anger are being considerably reduced. And the Chinese version here also mentions ignorance. Come to the third. What is the person who, having surfaced, remains standing? Having remained standing, observes, and having observed, crosses over, and having crossed over, reaches the farther bank. Here a person has surfaced by gaining faith in the true Dharma, etc. Through such knowing and seeing, the 5 lower fetters are eliminated, namely lustful desire, ill will, personality view, clinging to precepts, and doubt. With these 5 lower fetters eliminated, he will be born in another heavenly realm and there attain final nirvana, having attained the condition of non-returning, not coming back to this world. So whereas the previous person we mentioned still will return one more time to be reborn in the world of sensuality, which according to Buddhist cosmology means the world of humans and of certain sensual heavenly realms. You may remember the realm of the 33 that we discussed last time with that coral tree, and that is also a realm within the sensual world. The gods there enjoy sensual pleasures. But the non-returner will only be reborn in another, much higher heavenly realm in the Brahma world, completely beyond sensual desire. What is the person who, having surfaced, remains standing? Having remained standing, observes. Having observed, crosses over. Having crossed over, reaches the farther bank. And having reached the farther bank, is called a Brahmin dwelling on the farther bank. Here, a person has surfaced by gaining faith in the true Dharma, etc. Through such knowing and seeing, he attains liberation of the mind from the taint of desire, from the taint of becoming, and from the taint of ignorance. Being liberated, he knows he is liberated. He knows as it really is, birth is ended. The holy life has been established. What was to be done has been done. There will not be another existence. This is the Arahant, the highest stage of awakening. So when I said earlier, I shall teach you about seven persons in the water, it was on account of this that I said it. This is what the Buddha said, and having heard the Buddha's words, the monks were delighted and remembered them well. So the main points we get in this simile, somebody is in the predicament of being in the water and just remains lying, submerged in the water, is the person who is just immoral. And somebody is able to come out, it surfaces, but then sinks back again into the water. And that is somebody who for some time practices the Dharma, becomes established in morality, but then later on gives it up again. A backslider, I call it. Somebody surfaces and remains standing as somebody who keeps morality. And then we come to the four stages of awakening. The one who observes, who has seen the truth. Discourses speak of stream entry often as the arising of the eye of Dharma, the Dhammachakku. This is a stream entry. Someone crosses over the water is a once returner. Reaches the farther bank is a non-returner. And the Arahant is called a Brahmin dwelling on the farther bank. Yeah, the reference to the Brahmin is only in the identification of this in the Madhyama Agama, not in the part I read to you before. But it's also found in the Pali. Brahmin here stands for holy man, not for a member of the caste. Why does one lose faith and the next one doesn't, while they both do the same practice? The first one practice must be lacking in. Well, it is not the question of the practice, I assume, but rather of one's commitment to it and of one's observance of the results and perhaps also the influence of others. I mean, why do two people stop smoking and one starts again to smoke? There's a number of reasons. One is the effort, one and self-discipline of that person. The other is being aware of the beneficial health results. And a third one is if somebody has stopped but all the friends around him or her keep smoking, it becomes very difficult. So I assume somebody who gets himself or herself established in morality but is surrounded by people who continue in all kind of indulgence, it will be much more difficult to maintain that practice. The redefining of Brahmin in that way, as is frequently done, must have been hard to swallow for Brahmins. In a way, yes, but it seems there are different strands of Brahmins we meet, which in the early discourses, there are those apparently who uphold that birth in a particular lineage or family means to be a Brahmin, But there are others who are quite receptive to this redefining of the Brahmin in the sense of inner mental qualities. But for some it must have been hard to swallow, yeah. So there's one more comment coming, I'll take that, and then I think we have come to our end. So without achieving stream entry, we can still sink when the conditions are gone. Yes, in a way you could put it like that, but I mean if one really practices and observes oneself and see how much oneself is more happy and one is of more a source of happiness for others, then even without having attained a stream entry, I believe there is relatively little chance to sink again, at least in the present life. But obviously, just as getting the fourth jhana will make you understand exactly the issue about when somanasa and domanasa disappear, so I assume if it's possible to achieve stream entry, that would be the best way to make sure that we will not sink down again. Yeah, that's it for today. I thank you all for your attention, and I hope that I have not been too boring, and one point or the other has been of some interest, and sometimes it gets a little technical. There are some things that I feel I should be touching on, but then sometimes also it becomes practical, and I hope you will continue navigating with me between these two extremes through the middle course of the Madhyama Agama. Thank you very much for your attention, and bye-bye.